This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It is no secret that African Americans make up the bulk of the prison population. This overrepresentation can begin in the schools when individuals exhibit behaviors that some see as requiring disciplinary action. In schools here and around the country, those actions often weigh heavier on African Americans than on white students. Minority children are more likely to receive out-of-school suspensions than their white counterparts, contributing to something called the school-to-prison pipeline, where African American students are introduced to the criminal justice system at an early age. Later in life, black drivers are stopped and searched at a higher rate than whites. And when brought into courts on various offenses, African-American defendants often get harsher sentences than whites for the same offenses. What emerges is a bias that needs to be recognized first and addressed. In Charlotte, there is a local initiative designed to do just that. Race Matters for Juvenile Justice has been working for years to reduce disparities for children of color, and they formed partnerships with the courts, law enforcement, social services, and the school system to that end. We're joined this hour by the co-chairs of Race Matters for Juvenile Justice, Elisa Chin Gary, who is also the clerk of Superior Court in Mecklenburg County, is here, along with Louis Trosh, a juvenile and district court judge in Mecklenburg County. And as I said, they're co-chairs of Race Matters for Juvenile Justice. Welcome to the program. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Nice.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Nice to have you here. And Dr. Susan McCarter is also with us. She's associate professor of social work at UNC Charlotte and a former juvenile probation officer and an expert on the school to prison pipeline. Thank you for being here too.
Thank you, Mike.
When did Elisa, and that is how you say your name, right?
Elisa, yes.
When did Race Matters for Juvenile Justice start and why?
We officially began in 2010. At that time, our senior resident Superior Court judge had conversations in our courts about race for some time and how it impacts justice. In 2010, we started an initiative called Courts Catalyzing Change, where we, the court, the judges, and court officials began to have the conversation and invite other partners into that conversation. So we invited many of our governmental partners that worked in our system serving the same body of children and families to start finding solutions around the equation of race and justice.
So am I hearing her correctly, Judge Trosh? Did the judges notice that something was out of balance, out of whack here?
Yeah, I'll tell you a story that happened to me maybe 7 years ago. I had two young men who were charged with trying to commit an armed robbery in juvenile court. And what struck me about the case was the recommendations. One of the young men was in detention, incarcerated, waiting for trial, which was not surprising with an armed robbery. But the other was home with his family. And the recommendations were that the one young man that was in detention stay in detention pending his trial, and the other young man stay at home with his family. And I, as I heard the case, decided to ask about, well, what's the difference between the two young men? And they both came from strong families. Neither had been in trouble before. Both were good students. None had any drug or gang activity. They came from a wealthier area of Charlotte or an upper middle class area of Charlotte, and in fact had been friends since they were 7 years old. The only difference I could see as I began the questions or went through the questions was that one of the young men was white. He was home with his family. The other young man was African-American. He was in detention. And as I looked at it, I realized that the players involved, including myself, weren't attempting purposely to treat the African-American defendant and the white defendant differently, but in fact, that's what we were doing. And that led me on a personal journey to look at this issue in more depth, and I think other judges were having similar experiences.
And I read this story, and part of the story you left out, if I'm not mistaken, and that is that the white defendant who was at home with his family was there with a lawyer and in a suit and tie, and the black defendant was there in whatever they wear in the county jail and not represented necessarily by a lawyer.
Well, they both actually did have attorneys that were appointed to represent them, but the white defendant was there in a suit and tie because he was with his family. The other young man came in shackles. They removed the shackles for court, but
is that automatically dispose a judge to look at a defendant differently?
Oh, yes. In fact, what I came out of that story with the most, or that case, the most haunting thing was how many times had I reacted just that way based on what I saw in court or assumptions that I had made or assumptions that the various folks that are in my courtroom, whether they be defense attorneys, district attorneys, law enforcement, probation officers.
Juries,
yes, all of us make based on appearances. And race is one of those things that affects us more than anything else.
Your group, Race Matters for Juvenile Justice, has formed coalitions with law enforcement, as I said, schools, social services, and the courts to talk about why a disproportionate number of black youth are more likely to get a jail sentence or to be suspended while they are in school. And what, after 6 or 7 years, have you determined?
Well, I would say that when we began looking at DMC,
DMC being
disproportionate minority contact, we studied it and we looked at criminogenic factors for the young person and their family. Once we began studying this, actually in 2002, the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act of 1974 was amended the fourth time. And when it was amended in 2002, the language changed from disproportionate minority confinement, which is incarceration, mm-hmm. to disproportionate minority contact. And that had two implications. The first implication was we began to look at the whole system instead of just the young person and the family. The second implication was we began to look at all of the contact points along the system. So now, if you fast forward to 2016, we begin to look not only at the offenses that young people commit, which we see a slight variation by race and ethnicity, but not statistically significant to predict the disproportionality and the disparities that we see. Mm. So it can't explain what we see on the back end. It's forced us, and RMJJ is one of the national leaders in this, it's forced us to look at the offense behaviors in addition to implicit bias and systemic or institutional racism.
And is the bigger problem, in your mind, systemic bias?
In my mind, yes, it is.
Are other courts in North Carolina or around the country involved in similar projects?
I would say yes. I do see RMJJ as being a national leader on this front, but there are other groups that are entrenched in bringing this to the fore and having a voice not only in North Carolina, but around the country. I believe that our work is somewhat groundbreaking. I say that because when you think of fairness in the system, when you think of racial equality and who's busy and involved in fighting and advocating for that, you normally think of grassroots organizations, people out in the community who are most vulnerable to these systems. What makes Race Matters for Juvenile Justice different and unique and groundbreaking in my eyes is that these are the system leaders who are organizing mm-hmm. for change and transformation. These are the system leaders who have created a mission and a vision around reducing and eliminating the disparate outcomes that we see. So I believe that there is a national agenda that is moving forward by several different national groups, the National Center for State Courts, the National Council for Family and Juvenile Judges. However, what we're doing in here in North Carolina at the leadership level is very unique.
Your group has met with, I know, and held seminars on this problem for other courts, for lawyers, for law enforcement, for court systems around the country, around the state, rather. Do they easily recognize this problem, or do they come to you because they've heard about it, they're curious about it, they don't see the problem in their courts until they come to you? How do they come to the realization or the recognition of this problem?
I think it begins with the data. One of the things that Race Matters, one of our six initiatives, is around research, evaluation, and database decision-making. And so when you seat a conversation in the data, it makes it less personal. people don't feel like they're going to be called a racist. They don't feel like their institution is on the firing squad. And it begins to de-escalate the conversation where you can invite them to bring their numbers, to examine their numbers. And then the byproduct of that is they begin to understand that this is not just a juvenile justice problem. It's not just a child welfare problem. It's in healthcare. It's in education. It's pervasive across systems. And that conversation we've seen begin in data.
And your organization, Race Matters for Juvenile Justice, your vision is for a community, and I'm quoting here, where the composition and outcomes of juvenile courts cannot be predicted by race or ethnicity, and that implies that today it can be.
So I've told that story, as Elisa said. We've been invited all over the country, San Francisco, Baltimore, by Casey Family Programs, by the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges, and other organizations to share what we've done. And so I told that story a lot, that I just told about the two young men. Only one person, when I say, and you all know what the difference is, I go through the whole, in a longer version of the story. Does anybody not know what the difference is before they know that one's black and one's white? Everybody knows. Every single time. One individual, and over thousands that I've told, did not know the difference, and they're not from the United States. That person legitimately did not know the difference. Everybody else knows the difference. And so that's one thing that I think when we get invited to other places to talk about our initiative, it's if you work in the court system, you can't not recognize that most of the people that come before you for criminal offenses or in foster care are people of color.
Well, you know, if you stand in the lobby of the courthouse and just watch people come and go, it's predominantly African Americans. Mm-hmm. People come to the courthouse for a lot of different reasons, not just because they're on trial. Sometimes they're on jury. Sometimes they're getting paperwork done. But if you just stand in the lobby, you can see that.
And
you can make an inference from that, I suppose.
Exactly. But what we've done is change the conversation from what did they do to come here to what are we doing to exacerbate or in part create the situation.
Since you started this program, have things noticeably changed within the Mecklenburg County court system?
We are doing many things differently, and I'll let my colleagues speak to that. One thing that I will say is that we are raising awareness and having a new conversation. I had the opportunity last year, I believe in May, to facilitate a conversation among our district court judges about implicit bias. How implicit bias, misperceptions that we have, stereotypes that we see, how that impacts decision-making, judicial decision-making. And that's a conversation that we would not have had not been comfortable having, would it not be for the work of Race Matters for Juvenile Justice. We've done some other things in terms of practice reformation.
So we have a bench card now that the juvenile court judges use to try to make sure that we don't make assumptions in court, that we get all the facts and make our decisions based on evidence. And I've got to mention that Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools, the police department, and a number of other Department of Social Services have been incredible partners with us.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the systemic problems that go right into the school system, as a matter of fact, when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Original Mattress Company, providing mattresses and bedding hand-built in the Charlotte factory and offered direct to the consumer. More info at originalmattress.com. Well, on the next Charlotte Talks, we meet North Carolina's Teacher of the Year, Bobby Kavnar. He's a British literature teacher in the Gaston County Schools, who believes that teachers are the equalizers, the keepers of America's promise of equal opportunity. And we'll hear more about his philosophy and about his teaching philosophy and about teaching excellence tomorrow on the program at 9. That's first. Then, the co-founder of Profound Gentlemen, that's a group working to get and keep male African-American teachers in the classroom. That's all tomorrow.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, with an likely UK exit from the EU, America's relationship with a key intelligence and global trade ally will change. What the British vote means for the U.S. economy, the 2016 presidential campaign, and global security.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Race Matters for Juvenile Justice Initiative with the two co-chairs of that organization, Elisa Chingeri, who is also the clerk of Superior Court in Mecklenburg County, and Judge Louis Trosh, a juvenile and district court judge in Mecklenburg County. Also, Dr. Susan McCarter, associate professor of social work at UNC Charlotte and a former juvenile probation officer. Let's talk about where this all is, because it's systemic. It involves schools and health care and social services and law enforcement and the courts and the jails and the prison system. But let's talk about the schools. Dr. McCarter, according to the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction, while black students make up 26% of total enrollment, they account for 57% of short-term suspensions and 62% of the students in alternative learning classrooms. Those are classes for people who are at risk of truancy, academic failure, behavior problems, and or dropping out of schools. Are the statistics for that and for suspensions out of need, or are we talking about this implicit bias that was referred to in the last segment here?
That sometimes is called the myth of behavior. So, Mike, when you talk about whether it's out of need, the question that a lot of people will ask when presented with short-term suspension rates that you just mentioned, or long-term suspension rates or expulsions, is, well, do youth of color behave differently or worse than white youth,
or more often?
Mm-hmm.
And do they?
They do not. They do not. We do know that there are some offenses where there are differences in crime commission based on race and ethnicity. So you'll see that white children commit more alcohol and drug offenses typically. You'll see that white children commit more weapons offenses, more vandalism. On the flip side, you'll see that black children commit more burglaries or robberies. However, those minor differences in crime commission can't explain the disproportionality or the disparities that we see. And for plenty of offense categories, you'll see that marijuana use, for example, is almost statistically the same between black youth and white youth, yet black youth are arrested 3.73 times more likely.
We know that our school system is not completely integrated and that there are majority black schools in the system, and it's happening around the country as well. In those schools, which are majority black and are sometimes run by African-American principals and teachers, is the rate of discipline for African-American students the same as it would be in other schools that are not majority black?
So the rate of discipline varies by school. There hasn't been any trend data to suggest that the administration of that school makes a big difference. In other words,
so that bias exists on both sides,
though. Correct. In other words, there are high suspending schools that are majority black students that are have black principals. There are also high suspending schools with majority white students and white principals.
How do you explain the implicit bias that would be in operation there among African-American administrators toward African-American students?
Well, what I would say to that is that implicit bias affects us all equally across race and across gender. There, when we're talking about systemic racism, we're talking about a culture that exists within an organization, regardless of those that are working in it. So, for example, I can recall being at a national conference in 2007 in which there were partners from all across this country. There were predominantly African-American court administrators and judges in Chicago, but their overrepresentation of African Americans was the same. In Texas, we heard from predominantly Latino court judges and administrators, but their disproportionality were the same. In Hawaii, we heard from Pacific Islanders and Asian descent, but their disproportionality was the same. When you're talking about...
Always toward African Americans or toward Latinos
toward non-whites.
Okay.
So we are always talking about the systemic nature because we see the commonality. So whether it is the schools or whether it is law enforcement or whether it is our criminal justice system,
right,
you will see these same patterns. So that takes us to a conversation about root causes. And we generally have that conversation in two contexts. We talk about implicit bias, it's what it is and its impact, and we also talk about how that is doesn't exist in a vacuum, but there's a historical context to how we perceive each other.
There's a 2009 study in Virginia that showed that black students had a 31% higher likelihood of disciplinary action for the same offense. In North Carolina, those disparities were reflected across a number of systems, as you've pointed out here. African Americans have a higher rate of death from diabetes than whites. Infant mortality rates are higher. Black fourth graders score lower in reading proficiency. They experience a higher rate of suspensions, comprise more of the prison population, are subject to more searched per seatbelt violation, or searches per seatbelt violation, and have a higher rate of unemployment, to name just a few of the categories that this seems to cross. Is there something at work here other than bias or living conditions that can be traced to these higher rates?
There's you cited a few monumental studies. There's a unique study out of the state of Texas that was conducted by the Council of State Governments. And because of the size of their data set, and the title of the study is Breaking Schools Rules, and Tony Fabello did the study in 2011. Because of the size of the study, they were able to use over a million cases, over a million children. And when you have a data set that's that large, you can identically match children based on their socioeconomic status, based on their family structure, based on all of the independent variables that 20 years ago we attributed to these outcomes. And this Council of State Government study found that when you measured 83 different variables, race was the primary driver behind these outcomes.
And this begins, when I read this yesterday, I was shocked. This begins shockingly at a very young age in preschool. Preschool nationally, black kids were 3.6 times more likely to be suspended from preschool than white kids. In K through 12, black students 3.8 times more likely to be suspended. And you're saying, what I heard you say in the last segment, is that the behavioral issues involved in these incidents are really no different from race to race. They're the same. We just come down, the stick comes down harder on black kids.
That's right. That's right. There are differences, but they're not statistically significant enough to predict the outcomes that we have. I listened to your show, I guess it was week before last, when you marked the one-year anniversary of the Charleston shooting.
Mm-hmm.
You and your panelists agreed that we needed to begin to address racism, and the first step in doing that was to have conversations. But after that point in the show, you got stuck on what's the next step. And I love that Race Matters for Juvenile Justice can really bring that next step to the forefront. So we're not only fostering these courageous conversations, but we have workforce development initiatives where we're training our community members in a race analysis called Dismantling Racism. We're doing practice change efforts. We're doing Speakers Bureau initiatives. We have six different dimensions of change, which really takes that conversation that you had 2 weeks ago and says, what are the next steps? How can we really begin to dismantle the effects of racism?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Because I think that, and I don't want this to get lost, What we've determined, I think, are hit on in Race Matters for Juvenile Justice is not that institutional racism or implicit bias is the only explanation for the disparities that we've been talking about today, but that it is an important part, and that our discussion in the past has been limited to personal responsibility or lack of resources, some of the things that you mentioned a moment ago. We do not say or believe that those things are not important, that those things don't need to be dealt with, but we are adding additional factors to the conversation because personal responsibility and resources and family structure and availability to a different way of looking at things only gets us so far. And so these new dimensions that we're bringing is taking us to that next step of, okay, what we've been trying to do for a long time isn't changing the numbers. The disparities continue to stay the same or in some places get worse over time.
Since Race Matters for Juvenile Justice started, I understand that Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools have revamped their discipline problems, or policy rather. Was that due to your organization or to some seminar that they attended that you sponsored or conversations you've had behind the scenes with them?
Well, CMS has been a great partner with RMJJ and has been a very active partner. We mentioned our two-day intensive training entitled Dismantling Racism. Our school superintendent has invested that time and made it mandatory for administration and principals. Outside of that, there have been some teachers who've had an opportunity to attend. I know that their conversations and the influence and leverage of RMJJ has led them also to seek private consultants that are helping them to integrate cultural proficiency.
I think I know the answer to this question, but I have to ask it. And I think that since you are the person who, Dr. McCarter, who is the expert on the school-to-jailhouse pipeline, when you have incidents where you are the African-American student and you are being disciplined at a higher rate or more severely than your white counterpart, who pretty much did the same thing, that cannot go unnoticed. And when it happens over time where you see other students with the same skin color experiencing the same thing, does that put a chip on your shoulder that may actually lead to more severe infractions of rules or law and lead you into this rabbit hole?
I can take a stab at that if you don't mind.
I would love for you to.
I'll take a stab of it because I'm the mother of two black sons.
I'm just going to tell you, it would put a chip on my shoulder.
I have told the story often of the first time my fifth grader was suspended from school. I tried diligently to work with the school officials for a less punitive response and mitigate the situation. Nevertheless, my son was suspended, and it wasn't because he did not have engaged parents. It wasn't because of his parents' educational level. It wasn't because we were dismissive of his behavior or because we weren't willing to work with the schools. It wasn't because of our socioeconomic level. It wasn't because of all of those things we say are factors. Nevertheless, my son had a very common outcome that many youth have. So how does that impact children?
Mm-hmm.
No doubt there's an opportunity for anger to set in, for disappointment, for hopelessness. I'm very fortunate that I am able to have a conversation, as many parents are, in depth about race and how that's going to impact their interactions, not just with schools, but with other governmental systems. So we started that conversation on that very day.
There are also more African-American children in foster care than whites. Is that because their parents are unable to take care of them or because of some bias in the system that more often removes African-American children from the family environment than it does white children?
Well, that's what brought us to Race Matters for Juvenile Justice. The initiative that Elisa mentioned earlier, Courts Catalyzing Change, came from a partnership with the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges and Casey Family Programs, where judges across the country said, we have a huge overrepresentation of African-American children of color, but most specifically African-American children in foster care. And we need to quit talking about it. We need to do something about it. And so we see this very similar issues in the foster care system. And we're fortunate here that our Department of Social Services and county have been very supportive, just like the school system and law enforcement here, with our initiative to take a really hard look at their practices and how that impacts their system.
Reading just reams of material yesterday about this was kind of eye-opening, the disparities in the criminal justice system between how whites and blacks are treated. According to Slate.com, in addition to blacks being stopped by police more often, which we know is true, they are also more likely to be arrested for drug use, despite the fact that whites use drugs at comparable rates. Blacks are more likely than whites or non-black minorities to be in jail while they await trial, something that stigmatizes the defendant, disrupts their lives, ruins their employment opportunities, makes it harder to prepare a defense. How long has the criminal justice system been aware of this, recognized it as a problem, et cetera, and as a lack of fairness within the system? How long has that been recognized?
We can go all the way back to before 2000 when our resident superior court judge, senior resident superior court judge Shirley Fulton, and our chief district court judge Bill Jones shut down court for 2 days and had us work with community building initiatives, Diane English and Octavia Sewell, to talk about just those issues. And that was in 2000. So we've recognized it for a long time. And again, we're fortunate that our county, under the leadership of our current county manager and others within that system, have looked at and changed the way our bond system works to try and remove or to create a bond system that's based on factors related to the statute, not other factors like what color are you or how much money do you have or what side of town do you come from. And so we've implemented that.
Poorer people also seem to struggle more with the justice system because they don't have the money to post bond, et cetera. And if they miss a day at work, they lose that job many times. And yet they don't seem to be getting breaks cut for them by the criminal justice system, which puts them deeper in a hole and causes them to have to commit crimes to survive.
It can be a vicious cycle. And I know Susan can probably talk more about the study from North Carolina about the traffic stops and how that impacts people.
Well, and the other thing that I was going to say is you spoke eloquently, Judge Trosh, about locally when we recognized the problem and began moving forward. Nationally, the amendments that I mentioned to the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act noted DMC. So there is actually financial penalty for juvenile justice not to address this problem, but in the adult system, that doesn't exist.
It's Dr. Susan McCarter, Associate Professor of Social Work at the UNC Charlotte, along with Judge Louis Trosh and Elisa Chin Gary, the Clerk of Superior Court. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mecklenburg Eye Associates, specializing in treatment of cataracts, glaucoma, macular degeneration, and diabetic eye diseases with 3 Charlotte area locations. Mecklenburg Eye Associates, 800-628-EYES. With a now likely UK exit from the European Union, America's relationship with a key intelligence and global trade ally will change. So, on the Diane Rehm Show at 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, they'll be talking about what the British vote means for the U.S. economy, the 2016 presidential campaign, and for global security. That's all upcoming. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can do it by emailing us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, searching for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
This is Robert Siegel. Did you know that your car can do a lot more than just get you to work and back and leak oil? That old car of yours can also bring all of us the latest news from the Middle East, or analysis of where the economy's going, or a great movie review. When you donate your old car to this station, they'll turn it into the programs you love. Here's how.
Call 855-277-2346 or visit WFAE.org to learn more.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about criminal justice and race matters for juvenile justice, particularly. That's an organization that was started about
6 years ago.
The two co-chairs of that organization are with us, Elisa Chin Gary, the clerk of Superior Court, and Judge Louis Trosh, a juvenile justice and a district court judge. Dr. Susan McCarter is also with us, associate professor of social work at UNC Charlotte and a former juvenile probation officer. Andrew on Facebook writes, what is the ratio of police patrols in predominantly African-American areas versus others? Statistically speaking, is the number of stops of African-American people higher because they patrol those areas more?
Well, that was the study that that you guys brought up a second ago. And Frank Baumgartner from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, did a beautiful analysis of the crime stop data in North Carolina. Curiously, North Carolina was one of the very first states to require that upon traffic stops that law enforcement record certain pieces of data. And so Frank was able to analyze millions of traffic stops. To your writer's point, these traffic stops actually were statewide, so they weren't limited to particular neighborhoods. But in the analysis, and you may be familiar with some of Frank's work, it was picked up in the New York Times under the title Driving While Black. Mm-hmm. And one of the interesting things, I think, to me, the most interesting thing that Frank found, because the disproportionality wasn't really surprising to us, one of the interesting things that Frank was able to do with his analysis was to remove the most egregious offenders. So the cops that were really kind of, you know, if you were to say the bad apples, he took those cops out of the analysis and reran the data, and his findings were exactly the same. So when we try to isolate, when Lou tells his story, sometimes he'll say, you know, I looked for the racist in the room. And you begin to realize that it's not about isolating one person's actions or even a handful of bad social workers or bad teachers or bad judges, that really there are systemic effects of what's happening.
You say that research shows that when it comes to predicting who goes to jail, it is not just about the actual crime or someone's record, that race is the number one predictor.
That's true. And actually, in a 2009 statewide analysis of Virginia data, there were four variables that predicted juvenile incarceration. And we classified those variables. There were seven variables tested. There were two that were legal variables: crime severity, how severe your crime is, and the number of prior petitions. Mike, you spoke to prior record before. We then used five extra legal variables: race, income, education, family structure, and whether or not young people lived in an urban, suburban, or rural location. When we completed the analysis for incarceration, four variables predicted incarceration, both crime severity and prior record, but those weren't the strongest predictors. The strongest predictors were extra legal variables, first and foremost being race, and second, which education. Was surprising to us, exactly, education.
What does that mean? Explain that. Why education?
Because, and I think we touched on this, I think you touched on this a minute ago, when children begin to disengage from education, their trajectory to the school-to-prison pipeline is much stronger. When you don't have success or connection social bonds to education, that's not a rewarding.
So are they disengaging from education because they're having a bad educational experience in that they feel they are falling behind their peers, or is it because they are treated more unfairly in school than their peers, and so they just lose interest because it's a losing game? Which is the problem?
Yes, yes, and yes, right? So there's an activity that a North Carolina education professor conducts where she plays Monopoly with students in the classroom. And these are graduate-level teachers who are studying to be teachers. And for the first part of the Monopoly game, she has only students of color play. After an hour of playing the Monopoly game, she invites white students to join the game. There are no original pieces left. The students have to cobble together something to play the game with. When they get to the game of Monopoly, the utilities have been bought up. The houses have been bought up. There's houses and hotels. Within 30 minutes of playing the game, the students become disengaged from the game. And towards the end of the game, they comment in the debrief of the game that really towards the end, all they wanted to do was land on jail so they wouldn't have to pay out.
These are the white students saying?
These are the white students who entered the Monopoly game.
Which demonstrates that when the deck is stacked against you, you lose interest.
I think that that's a wonderful experiment to bring to the fore, because these are graduate students in a structured environment, who are doing an exercise. Imagine that if that was your whole life and what you knew to be true for your family and your community for generations. One of the things that RMJJ does that I'm very proud of is that we have built our muscle to talk about race. Often it takes courage and it takes practice, but we have taken that deep dive so that we not only talk about implicit bias, that unconscious, unintentional brain factors and how that weighs into our work and into our conversation, but we also are courageous enough to really talk about the dark side of our American history and how that has had an impact on influencing those biases.
And we've started talking about that with young people. So Nikia Weiler and Jason Williams from the Possibility Project and Mecklenburg Ministries have brought this discussion, these courageous conversations, to a whole group of young people who are now out there working within their schools and across the community to bring this conversation to kids who are seeing the same messages that we see.
Yeah. But kids aren't in control. So if you're living that Monopoly experiment on the wrong side of that Monopoly experiment, how do you fix that?
Well, I would say that it is everyone's problem to fix. Which side you're on, as you said, is not a choice. So what is important to us is that we build and we organize those who are prepared to do this work. And we believe that that happens effectively when you have a racial lens. I have said to many audiences that I have a law degree and a master's in social work. I left my academic institution really believing that I was prepared and well-equipped to serve the most vulnerable in our society. But it was only until I really developed a racial analysis that I was able to do this work effectively. So we want judges. We want social workers. We want health professionals, we want police officers to do the work effectively. And that requires understanding their implicit biases and also developing this racial analysis.
We like to say that justice is blind. Clearly it is not. Do most Americans want it to be?
I think everyone wants it to be. I know when I was a judge, I certainly wanted it to be. That's when I see it in court or I see it in myself, that I am, in fact, making assumptions about people based on their appearance, it's horrifying for me.
Yeah.
But but now that I know that I do that individually, personally, and I know that so does everyone else, and understand that that's because we're human beings and the way that our brain is organized and the way that we are given messages and receive those messages about individuals and, more importantly, groups of people, now I can do something about it. Until I make that acknowledgement that, in fact, I do make assumptions about people. I'm 6'6", Mike, and I guarantee if you and I talk for a while, you would assume that I play basketball through nothing else other than I'm 6'6". Well, we make assumptions like that about people all the time,
yeah,
and it impacts what we do. And race matters for juvenile justice we've gotten past or we've gotten to the place where we recognize that we make those assumptions and we've done it together so that I'm not pointing the finger at police officers. They're not pointing their fingers at judges or the school system. In fact, we've all acknowledged through looking at the data and having conversations that this is something that all of us need to own. And when we all own it, we can come up with solutions.
But we also seem to make progress and then retrench on the progress because the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act were in the mid-60s. Yet according to the Washington Post, and that was supposed to address a lot of the problems and a lot of the disparities from Jim Crow and slavery and on back. But according to the Washington Post, incarceration rates of black men have skyrocketed since 1980. And even though incarceration rates for white men also rose in that same period as we got tough on crime, that rise is eclipsed by the rate of black male incarceration. And the paper reports that the net effect of this is that the future employment prospects for black males is significantly worse than for white males and worse than it was between 1940 and 1980. This is a vicious cycle and one that was unrecognized until somebody looked at the aggregated data, I would presume. Is that due to policy changes? Is it due to get tough on crime? Is it due to implicit bias? Both? What? Or reaction on the parts of white people to looking at black people suddenly getting ahead and, by God, we're going to stop that?
Well, let me put it this way to go to the Monopoly analogy. One thing Susan didn't say about that game was when the white students came into the game, like the Civil Rights Act, they were given the same rules. They got the same amount of money that everyone gets when you – I don't know what the amount is, $1,500 when you right. start Monopoly. The rules were the same, but they were so far behind. The deck had been, as you said, the deck had been so stacked, they never caught up. And so some of this has to do with we feel like we've equalized everything.
Right.
But we haven't undone what we had done for decades.
And how do you do that? Because Monopoly is a good example, because once all the property and all the money is controlled by certain people playing the game, it's hard to come in and suddenly get your share of the pie or even get ahead. That's a good thing. That's what's happened in society. So how do you change that?
You spoke, about the plight of African-American males. And what I would say to that is that historically there's always been a plight, whether we're talking about slavery, whether we're talking about the period after Reconstruction, whether we're talking about lynchings during the Jim Crow South, whether we're talking about mass incarceration now, there has always been a historical pattern. And that's how deeply we are beginning to see the systemic nature.
Because if you're living on Baltic Avenue, In Monopoly world, it's really difficult if all the other properties have been taken for you to buy Park Place or Boardwalk. It's really almost impossible.
Well, we do this work with a lot of faith. We don't believe that anything is impossible. I think it's the quote by Nelson Mandela that says, it was impossible until it was done. So we do this work knowing that our efforts are meaningful, that we are making practice changes, that we are raising people's awareness, that we are developing leaders who have this racial analysis, and that children and families are being, and our entire community is being positively impacted by it.
Everybody has a bias, and everybody has prejudices against other people, et cetera, and they come from all sorts of different sources. And most times, with this explicit bias, we know enough to be politically correct and hide those biases. Implicit biases may be difficult to recognize. How do we learn to recognize things that we don't even see in ourselves?
So Jennifer Eberhardt did some interesting work. She's at Stanford, and she actually examined implicit bias with three different groups of students. She had a group that had no prime at all. She had a group that was primed with subliminal pictures of black Stanford faculty, staff, and students. And then a third group who was primed with white pictures of Stanford faculty, staff, and students. They were shown the image, these photographs at the subliminal, at 31 seconds, milliseconds. So their brain did not see them their implicit mind saw them, or their unconscious or subconscious saw them. And then she measured how long it took people to identify line drawings of crime-related objects or crime-irrelevant objects, so as a gun, handcuffs, a knife, or a stapler, a cup and saucer, except a bugle. There's a marked difference. So for the group that didn't have primes, they were able to identify the two groups of objects at the same rate. For the group that was, and everybody across all three groups, identified between 23 and 24 frames it took them for the crime irrelevant objects. Once shown crime relevant objects, folks that were primed with white faces, it took them longer to identify a gun, a knife, or handcuffs. For people who were primed with black faces, statistically significantly shorter amount of time. So to the Honorable Clerk Chingeri's point of earlier, what we're up against is a lifetime of experiences, media portrayals, etc., that are in our subconscious and unconscious minds, which we know that we've learned and which can effectively be unlearned. And that's part of the work of RMJJ, is to help people unlearn those implicit biases.
I wish I could ask you about why we're starting with juvenile justice when hundreds of thousands of people who are adults have been already impacted by this and are sitting in prisons around the country, but we're out of time. Thank you for being here this hour. It's been enlightening. Elisa Chingeri, Clerk of Superior Court in Mecklenburg County, Louis Strauss, a judge there, co-chairs of Race Matters for Juvenile Justice, and Dr. Susan McCarter from UNC Charlotte.